All right, welcome back, everybody. It's good to see you. Hope everybody is staying warm and safe. Our parsha tonight begins. Unfortunately, we didn't meet last week, so it might come to you as a surprise. We're done with Abraham. We're done with Isaac. Welcome, Jacob. If you missed 1 or 2 weeks, you're like, what? I thought we just were finishing with Moshe. Yeah, it moves pretty quickly the first book or two. So we have the parsha begins with this fateful meeting that Esau, and Jacob, his brother, are about to have. If you remember, Jacob ran away after he got the firstborn rights, and he, quote unquote, took the blessings away from Esau. And Esau swore up and down in his heart that when dad dies, I'm going to take this out on Jacob and I'm going to kill him. So Rivka, a good old mom, comes to Jacob and says, now's a good time to go find a wife. See ya. Right? Go find a wife. Get out of here. Go get out. So he has to flee. So he goes away. Our parsha begins now, approximately 20 some odd years later, almost 22 years. Esav and Yaakov are now going to meet. And our parsha begins with the preparation that Yaakov has for meeting his brother Esav. He does three things. One, he prays that God should save him and his family. Number two is he sends expensive tribute and gifts to Esav to try to win him over. And three is he the alternative, if it doesn't work, is he prepares for battle and he splits his family into two different camps. See, they had Camp Sheresh back then also, two different places. Right? You have different camps. If God forbid Esav were to come and attack camp number one, at least camp number two would be saved. But I want to focus for a minute on two things. One is, what actually did Jacob pray for? What did he want to accomplish? So let's look. If you have a Chumash in front of you, great. If not, as always, I'll just read it out loud. It's chapter 32 in the book of Bereshit. And you take a look at verse 12. It reads as follows: Hatzileni na, please save me, miyad achi, miyad Esav, from the hand of my brother, from the hand of Esau. Ki yarei anochi oto, because I am afraid of him, pen yavo vehikani, perhaps he will come and he will smite, aim al banim, even mother against children. He'll wipe out mother and child. He won't care. Esav, I know, is still so angry. Please, God, save me from Esav. Seems like a reasonable request. He knows that Esav is probably fuming. In fact, I didn't tell you this, but the first opening line of the story in this week's parsha is where Yaakov actually sends messengers to go see, well, how's Esav been doing? Has he calmed down? And the response back is that, yeah, he hasn't cooled down one bit. He's on his way to greet you, and he's coming with 400 men. Wink, wink. Wake up. This is not going to be pretty. So Yaakov prays to Hashem, please, I beg of you, help me, save me from Esav. It seems reasonable, does it not? But the problem is, if you read the text carefully, and I'll make, as I love to do, I'm going to put the emphasis on a certain syllable so you don't miss it. Okay? That was a joke, Arlene. Okay. Here, he says, please, Hatzileni na, please save me, miyad achi, from the hand of my brother. Wait, pause. Sid, who's his brother?
Esau.
Esau, we all know that, do we not? Okay, but he continues in his prayer, save me, please, from the hand of my brother, Miyad Esav, from the hand of Esau. Well, it sure sounds like the Department of Redundancy Department. We know who Miyad Achi, from the hand of my brother. I know who that is. I haven't been to shul, but I've heard the Torah reading. I've read it. I know who his brother is. Tell me either from the hand of my brother or from the hand of Esau. I don't need both as part of his prayer. I think that's a fair question. Alan, you're okay with that question? Yes. I think it's a great question. It's not mine. But it begs the question, either but not both. And question number two, at the end of the story, is his prayer answered? What was it that he was praying for that he had to use two descriptors? And was his prayer answered? Question number one, or 1A and 1B. But let's go to where they actually meet. Just one chapter later, in chapter 33, in verse 4. I'll start a little earlier. Jacob raised his eyes and he saw, behold, Esav was coming, and with him were 400 men. So he divided the children amongst Leah and Rachel and the two handmaids. He put the handmaids and their children first, Leah and her children next, and all fine. Then he himself went ahead of them, bowed to the ground seven times until he reached his brother. Verse 4, here we go. Esav ran towards him, embraced him, fell upon his neck, and kissed him. Then they cried. Then they wept. Was that the conclusion of, or is that what you envisioned was going to be what this meeting? Esav has had pent up energy and anger for two decades. And he's finally coming. He's got his 400 men. I'm sure Esav, as the hunter, has his bow, has his arrow. He's got his spear. He's ready to roll. And sure enough, that fateful encounter, and Esav, oh, come here, Tzatzkala, come here, Bobola. And he gives him a hug and a kiss. And really? That's what you anticipated? I didn't see that one coming. That's like almost like a Hollywood script that just flips on you. You didn't see that one coming. However, those of you who do have a chumash in front of you, you may be able to note this. But in that verse, again, 33, number 4, where it says that Esav embraced him, fell on his neck, the next word is, and he kissed him. If you have the Hebrew in front of you, you will note it's the second to last word in the verse. Vayishakehu. It means, and he kissed him, and right? That's what it means. Do you notice anything weird about the way that word is written? Yeah, Sandy.
Dots on top. Ahead.
What?
Dots on top.
There's a whole bunch of dots over the word. This is not because the printer got it wrong and there was some extra ink on the roller. This is the real deal. In a real Torah, there are dots hanging over this word. That's weird. Why are there dots over a word? It's very, very uncommon. Do you ever notice that before, Sid?
No.
Amazing. My job here is done. It's
not quite. Thing.
Why are there dots? So are the Medrash, again, a great early traditional Jewish source, is bothered by this and tells us a fascinating piece of information that's going on behind the scenes that are meant to, but the dots being there is supposed to catch your eye and say, whoa, what kind of kiss was this? Is this a real kiss? There's something weird about this kind of kiss. Says the Medrash that really, before I give you the answer, are you bothered by one other expression? In between the embrace and the kiss. Should I read the verse again? Because not everybody has the
chumash. Fell on his neck.
He fell on his neck. That's a weird one. Yeah. Last I check, if you want to embrace somebody, you put your arms around them. You don't rest your head on their neck. You want to say that you cuddled up to the person, you embraced them, you held them tight, and then you kissed them? I'm on board. But falling on his neck? Well, that seems to be weird also. How else would you have done it when you embraced him? So the Medrash tells us the following, a little behind the scenes. What really happened is that Esav did not come with his arms wide open, so excited to see his brother. He ran towards him and he embraced him and he immediately went towards his neck. to cut his jugular. The way that the Medrash phrases it is that he tried to bite him on the neck. I don't know if that means literally, but it means he went after him like you ever watch National Geographic of what goes on in the wild when a jaguar, right? They grab it by the neck. It's a symbol of I'm there to hurt you. Esav's true intention was to bite him, to hurt him. And the Medrash says, miraculously, Jacob's neck turned to stone and he was unable. So he kissed him instead. Really? Okay. I get it. It's a great story. You want to tell it over in Hebrew school? Fine. Great story. And all the kids are like, wow. But what are we supposed to make of this? How are we supposed to understand this? So I think we can answer both questions with one concept, one very important theme. If I were to ask you to please conjure up in your mind or to summarize and depict what has been the Jewish experience in exile for the past 2,000 years, what immediately comes to mind? What kind of picture do you have in your head of the experience that the Jewish people have had over the past 2,000 years since the destruction of the Second Temple? Go ahead, share with me. What comes to mind quickly?
Exile.
Go ahead. That's just a word, but you know, make believe I just landed from another planet. And I'm asking you, can you tell me a little bit about the Jewish experience over the last two millennia?
Programs.
Pogroms.
Hardships.
Hardships.
Persecution.
Persecution, right? We can go around and around and they're all going to have the same theme. The classic picture that we think of. Yes, it's true. Thank God it hasn't been nonstop for 2,000 years. There have been, thank God, there have been periods of relative quiet and tranquility. But if you had to pick a theme that has been recurring for so long, it's not a pretty picture. It's a difficult one. It's, you know, who have we faced? We faced Esav. What's the picture you have in your mind of the classic picture of Esav? I don't know about you, but for me, it's the rough and tough, gruff kind of guy, hairy brute who's out there in the field. He's a hunter. He's the guy who's been persecuting us for so long. In my mind, I picture when I think of Esav, I don't think of this nice, genteel kind of guy who, oh, what can I do for you, my friend? No, I'm thinking of Esav as this harsh, real, you know, the wicked enemy who is bent on annihilation. The classic picture that I just asked you of, the Jewish experience. It's the sad truth, but the fate of the Jewish people since the destruction of even the first temple has been, we were exiled into Babylonia and we suffered greatly there. They were taken over by the Persians, and you have the story of Purim with King Ahasuerus and Haman coming up with what was the first of many final solutions to rid the world of us. Greece, Rome, Spain, Europe. How about the current state of Israel being surrounded by enemies nonstop? This is the Esav of the world that I picture. But my friends, there's another side to Esav that is just as dangerous, but he doesn't come across that way. He comes across as our brother. He comes with love. He comes with open arms to welcome us. What do you mean? Rabbi, wouldn't that be awesome? Wouldn't it be great if everyone loved us and people stopped hating us? In 1999, Professor Alan Dershowitz wrote a very famous book called The Vanishing American Jew. He describes what perhaps is a unique experience in all of Jewish history, that here in America, we can no longer count on all of the tsaris, all of the hardships from external persecution or hatred to keep us together. Unfortunately, in America, it's the opposite. We have been welcomed with open arms to a point of assimilating and losing our identity. They're loving us to death. Oh, it's much more insidious than coming at you with a pitchfork, coming at you with a gun or a knife. That you recognize as your enemy. But what we don't often see is that there's another enemy, and this is the one who is welcoming you with open arms. And you become so assimilated and so a part of the culture, you forget who you are. And you give up what is your true identity. I had the privilege once. Some of you may have heard of him, Rabbi Noach Weinberg of blessed memory. He was the founder of Eish HaTorah, the great institution that has done unbelievable work in terms of Jewish outreach. I once had the privilege. I was living in Columbus. I guess I had been somewhat successful, and I get a call from somebody who works at Eish saying that Reb Noach wants to start a new program. And I heard you doing great things. We want to interview you. So fine. I figured, can't hurt. So I get interviewed, and I guess I did well. The next thing I know, they want me to fly to New York, because Reb Noach, who had been living in Israel, which is the center of Eish HaTorah, Reb Noach was coming into New York, and they wanted me to meet him. So I flew. I had a wonderful meeting with him. But the kernel of what Reb Noach said to me, and it wasn't unique to me, this was his message at all times. He said, the Jewish people are going through another Holocaust right now. No, it's not the Holocaust of Europe, of where it was a physical annihilation, an attempt to wipe us out physically. He said, we're facing the spiritual Holocaust. How many have we lost and are currently losing? To assimilation, to those who have been welcomed with such open arms to the extent that the rest of the world wants to marry us and wants us to marry them and to absorb ourselves into the foreign culture. Listen, don't get me wrong. I thank God every day that I live in this country, that I have the freedom to be able to practice the religion that I choose, that I can get on a call on a Zoom and have no fear of any persecution. Thank God I live in this country.
Amen.
I do not take it for granted. However, we are doing ourselves a tremendous disservice if we think it's all rosy, if it's all a perfect picture. It is not. There is a definite danger, much, much, much more insidious, that you don't realize. Yaakov is about to meet Esav. Jacob is going to have this encounter with Esav. And he davens and he prays to God, please, I know that I'm going to be facing this challenge. Who am I going to be facing? Is it the Esav that we know, the classic picture of Esav, the one who's coming at us as an enemy, sworn enemy, that he's going to kill his brother Jacob? Or is he coming at me as my brother? Not as Esav, classic picture, but as my brother. Open arms, come here, Bubala. Let's see how we can all work together. If you think about it, this is exactly the order of events that the Midrash is trying to tell us about what happened at the actual encounter. When Esav first came, of course he's angry. That's why he came with his whole army of 400 men. He's ready to exact vengeance against Yaakov for all that he had done to him. He's angry. He first tried to bite him. He first tried to kill Yaakov as the classic Esav. But when that became he became unable, that didn't work. Then he decided to try option number two. He tried to approach him as Esav, his brother. He tried to kiss him to death, perhaps. Where do we see what happens in the end? If you go a little bit further in the next chapter, in chapter 33, right after the hug and the kiss, Esav asks Yaakov, what's with all of this? You have so many children and wives and flock and cattle. And woo, where'd you get all of this? And he says, no, please, I want you to have some. He offers the tribute to Esav. Why are you, what did you intend by sending me all of it? I want to find favor in your eyes. He's very humble before Esav. In verse number 12, Esav turns to him after he's convinced that Yaakov is a good guy, whatever that means. He says, travel on, let us go. I will proceed alongside you. Esav says, okay, I can't destroy you. I tried that approach. Let me try option number two. Let's go together. Let's start traveling. Me with my entourage, you with your family. Let's go together. We'll do like a caravan. What is Yaakov's response? No, don't you realize my children are still very young? I have nursing flock, the cattle. If we push too hard, it's going to kill everyone. I can't do it. Yaakov gives all of his excuses why he can't. He can't. And ultimately, believe it or not, at the end of that particular chapter, they go their separate ways and they did not even spend one day, one whole day together. Yaakov realizes if he can't be successful in trying to physically kill me, he's going to try and win me over and have me assimilate and lose who I am. I can't afford that either. This, unfortunately, has really been the epitome of Jewish history. Think about it. When the exile first started, it was not pretty. We faced Roman persecution in our own homeland, in Israel. Under Roman occupation, they started making decrees. Cannot study or teach Torah publicly. No more circumcision. They started saying you can't keep Shabbos. Slowly but surely, they ultimately took over, destroyed the temple, and exiled us. And then we faced, in a not such a further distance in history, we started facing the Christian, right, persecution, all of the forced conversions. You come to Spain, you come to an Inquisition, you come to a Holocaust. This is the classic Esav, the one that's out to physically destroy. But then you come to ours. Thank God for the last little bit, certainly in this country, for 200 years, it's been quiet. When even the final solution of Hitler failed, the second option of acceptance and brotherhood now became the operational mode. This becomes the MO now. I don't want to paint a bleak picture. That's not my point. My point is that we have to be on guard from both sides. There are two kinds of Esavs that we face. We face the more obvious one. That's where they call us by name. They call us dirty Jew. We're familiar. We know all of those stories. But there's another kind of Esav that we need to be on guard with. And that is to a point of where we are so accepted in society that our Judaism doesn't matter anymore. The way that we've always survived is by having pride in who we are. Come thick or thin, heck or high water, I'm not giving in. You asked me, Monroe, about the word ne'eman, faithfulness. Yeah, that's what I'm talking about. There's a certain pride and trust. I can't explain why this is our fate. It's not my place to do that. But do I trust that my commitment to staying the course through the great times, the highs, as well as the lows? Yes, that's what we need to do. Let's even look at one further point to this. In that same chapter, in chapter 32, as part of his prayer, right after he says to God in verse 12, please save me from my brother, from the hand of my brother, from the hand of Esav. In the next verse, V'atomarta, God, he's still praying. God, you had said to me, hey, Tev, Etivimach, it will be good for you. I don't worry, God says to Jacob, I got your back. It will be good. V'samti et zaracha kechol hayom. You promised me, God, that you will make my seed like the sand at the sea, the seashore. Asher lo yisafer meirov, that they're too numerous to even count. This sounds vaguely familiar to you. One of the blessings about the Jewish people is that God says, I'll make them like the sand at the seas. Two, you can't count them. That's how great they'll be. Hey, folks, I got a little issue with this. This is not the blessing God gave Jacob himself. If you turn back, when God was talking to Jacob and gave him the blessing not to fear and that he can go down when he runs away from his brother Esau, don't worry, he says. I'm going to make you like the dirt of the ground and like the stars in heaven. He does not use the expression like the sand at the sea. That's one that you remember. I know it's in there, but you're remembering it from a previous story with Abraham. It wasn't to Jacob. To Jacob was a different blessing. It would be more like the dirt of the ground. Then why does Jacob, in his repetition or in his request of God, but God, you promised me things would be good. You told me that my descendants would be as great and numerous as, I'm expecting him to say, the blessing he got directly from God regarding the dirt, the ground. But yet he makes reference not to his blessing, but to the one, the promise that God gave Abraham. Why the switch? Why now go to the Zadies, go to the grandfather's blessing? What happened to the one God gave him? Another good question, Alan. I know. I see the wheels turning. You know what? There's one major advantage or lesson that one can learn from the sand at the sea that has a greater advantage over the dirt of the ground. There are many, but one in particular. Aside from the promise of quantity, that it's going to be so numerous, Jacob understood that the blessing God gave Abraham also had the promise of quality. That despite the constant pounding of the waves, every minute of every day, nonstop, the sea, the sand at the sea never, ever, ever loses its identity. When it gets mixed with water, sure, it overwhelms the sand. And then when the water recedes, guess what's still there? Sand. It's still there. Yeah? I tried davening outside with my minion the other day when it was pouring. You know what those little particles of dirt became? Mud.
Mud.
Yeah. How about those granules of dirt then? Yeah, what happened to them? Gone. They got absorbed. That's it. Their identity, gone. Yaakov is turning to God and he says, please protect me. Not just from the Esav I recognize, but protect me from the Esav that's a little bit more scary, a little more dangerous. Give me the strength, like you promised my grandfather Abraham, that I and my descendants will be like the sand at the sea. We will remain unchanged. We will not fall and cave to either the pressures or the influences of the foreign cultures. Let it be that I remain strong with my Jewish pride. David.
I was just reflecting back on verse 13, and as I read it, it says, you have said, not specifically you have said to me.
Correct. That is correct. That is exactly the point. You have said, not to me, but I have on record what my grandfather told me. That's a promise you gave. But the question is so powerful. Like, why didn't you talk about what you got? The answer is because at this moment, he's expressing his concern about the other Esav, the brotherhood Esav. I need to rely on the grandfather's blessing that we will remain strong despite that brotherhood, despite that love. I think it's important that we take a minute and try to understand just how prone and susceptible we are to this problem. I you know, when God took us out of Egypt, he brought all the plagues and he split the sea and he performed miracle after miracle after miracle. Quickly, just by a show of hands, who was the message intended for? I'll give you choice A, the Egyptians, choice B, the Jews. C, both, D, none of the above.
Jews.
You say B, the Jews.
Yeah.
Okay.
I say both.
You say both. What do you say, Sharon?
Both.
Both. Michelle. Both. Sid, Michelle, both.
Both.
You think both?
You're talking about the plagues.
Yeah.
I'm talking about the plague. I'm talking about everything. Well, if you read carefully, if you read the text carefully, we don't have the time for it, but if you look in chapters 7-8 of the book of Shemot in Exodus, you will see consistently that it's all about proving it to the Egyptians. Doesn't say anything about a message to the Jews. Mm-hmm. I want Pharaoh to know that I am God. I want Pharaoh and the Egyptians to know that I control nature. I want Pharaoh and the Egyptians to know that I rule. It doesn't say anything, to the best of my knowledge, that the Jews need to learn a lesson. Really? I would have thought that all of this was for us. Of course, the Egyptians have a lesson to learn because they need to be punished for what they did. But ultimately, I thought it was that we learn who God is. Because we're about to leave. We're about to become his nation, given a Torah 7 weeks later at Mount Sinai. But it doesn't seem to stress that. It stresses all about the impression that it's making on the Egyptians. Why? Why would it be? Unfortunately, the answer is because as Jews, you know what our barometer of what's important in life? You know what we use to gauge what we think is important? It's what everybody else thinks. We're always looking. Well, what do they think? You ever wonder, how is it that the entire books of Tanakh, all the books of the prophets, they all give tremendous rebuke to the Jewish people? And what it is? What are they doing that is so horrific? Prophet after prophet. What are they doing wrong? Give it to me in one word.
Idolatry.
Idolatry. Idol worship. Really? Folks, we're talking about the Jewish people here. We have never, it's fascinating. There has never, ever, ever been in our history one new idol that we invented. Never. Every idol that we ever worshiped was we took it from someone else. Really? Yeah, because unfortunately, we have this feeling in our head. We have this idea that whatever they respect, oh, I guess it's important, and now I have to see it that way. And we become so obsessed with that mentality of, well, I guess the culture says this is important. Look, everybody's doing it. Everybody's getting it. And we start taking those on. This is our Achilles heel. We're so interested in fitting in with everybody. We're so interested in not being different. This is our Achilles heel. There's a story that's told in the Medrash and it's been borne out numerous times in our history of people who were searching out, trying to find God in their life. And they go visit and they go to this non-Jewish prophet. They go to this non-Jewish leader. They go to the Dalai Lama. They go to all the great, and there are wonderful, wonderful leaders in the non-Jewish world. But the Medrash tells us, I'm talking about the Dalai Lama, it's a little too early. But the Medrash tells a story about the great prophets, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, how they sacrificed their lives in to sanctify God's name. They refused to bow down to idols. The Medrash says that after that miracle, the head of the non-Jewish leadership turned and he says, I don't understand you people. You Jews have a God that saves people from fiery furnaces. You have a God that listens to your prayers, and you're coming to me to worship an idol? What's wrong with you?
Self-confidence.
This is our problem. This is the problem. I'll show it to you. One other case. I don't want to hold you too long here. One more case. After the ninth plague in Egypt, the ninth plague, here's what it says. I'll read you the text and I'll allow you to tell me what it means. Okay? It's if you want to see it, it's in Exodus chapter 11, verse 3. Right? The warning of the plague of the firstborn. This is now after the ninth plague. We're moving on to number 10. God says to Moses, one more plague shall I bring upon Pharaoh and upon Egypt. After that, he shall send you forth from here. When he sends you forth, it shall be complete. He shall drive you out of here. Please speak in the ears of the people. Listen carefully. Please speak. Okay? Please speak in the ears of the people. Let each man request of his fellow and each woman from her fellow silver vessels and gold vessels. Hashem granted the people favor in the eyes of Egypt. I'll read it again. God, Hashem, granted the people favor in the eyes of Egypt. They won favor. Moshe is viewed as a great man in the eyes of Pharaoh's servants and in the eyes of the people, it says. Moreover, the man Moses was very great in the land of Egypt, in the eyes of the servants and in the eyes of the people. That last phrase, Moshe now was considered a great leader in Pharaoh's eyes, in his servants' eyes, and in the people's eyes. Yes? Do we see that? So Pharaoh's eyes, I understand. His servants, his cabinet, his ministers, I understand. Who's the last one referring to? That in the eyes of the people, Moshe was considered great. Who do you understand the verse to be talking about?
Jewish people.
You think it was the Jewish people? It's talking about the Egyptians. Egyptians. Every line of this was all about Pharaoh, Pharaoh's servants, and in the eyes of all the people. But you're Robin, you're on good footing. One of the greatest commentators, Nachmanides, says, yes, it was finally Moses was considered a great leader in the eyes of the Jews. Really? Why? Says Nachmanides, because remember, the earlier they questioned Moshe, they complained about his leadership, but now they see that he's considered important and a great leader in the eyes of Pharaoh, in the eyes of Pharaoh's leadership and cabinet. Oh, I guess Moses must be a great leader. But it's true. We work so hard. I should say it better. We've come so far to just lose sight and to just give it all up to quote unquote fit in. Listen, again, I'm not knocking anything about our country. I don't mean to knock anything about non-Jews. But if it's going to cost us our Jewish identity, I have a problem with it. It cannot be at that cost. We have to have that sense of who we are. This country was founded on that principle that nobody was meant to be the same. You be you and feel comfortable living here. You don't have to be me. I don't have to be you. I can live my life. And you can live yours, and we can be friends. But if it gets to a point of where I lose sight of who I am and what's valuable to me, then we have thrown it all away. The problem that we are facing here in the States, and it's not just here, it's all around the world. Everybody always talks about Jewish continuity, the importance of recognizing that, you know, assimilation is such. You know what the root of the problem is? It's not that we lack faith in Judaism. It's that we're so uneducated as to what it is, and everything else looks so much cooler. It's so much more glitzy. Oh, look what I can do. I can have this. I can have that. Oh, Judaism says I can only eat certain kinds of food. I can only work 6 days a week. I can't do this and I can't do that. And I have to bring this. And oh my God, if I hear one more about a Jewish organization campaign, I'm going to go nuts. Right? But that's who we are, folks. That is who we are. And the minute that we forget that, we lose our identity of who we are, we don't stand a chance. We don't stand a chance. This was the original blessing when God told Abraham to take his initial journey. Lech lecha, go, right? This is the beginning, the origin of our religion, of our people. It starts with Abraham's journey. He says to him, lech lecha, go. But the word lech means go. What's lecha for you? One of the great commentators tells us, you have to go, know, and become lecha. Become your own self. Don't let yourself be defined by your societal influences, your land. Don't let it be determined by only your biological factors. You can rise above it. And you do not have to be based on the messages you received in your youth. Lech, go, lecha. Go find yourself. Find out who you really are and then stick with it. Avram knew that he could become Avraham. Abram knew in his heart that that was not his end result. The ending had to be he became the great Abraham. Even though he was not exposed to such lofty qualities in his father's home, he grew up in a difficult place, a tough environment, one that did not promote free thinking, different way, go against conventional wisdom. That was a death sentence from King Nimrod. But Avraham said, I got to be true to myself and I have to know who I am. This is the message. Yaakov, let's go back to our questions. Our questions were, number one, what was his prayer? His prayer was from the hand of my brother and the hand of Esau. I asked, it's redundant. We know who his brother is. We know who Esau is. Why both? The answer is because he realizes he's facing two different challenges. Was his prayer successful? Question 1B. The answer is yes. Was he able to diffuse the situation from the angry Esau? Yes. Did he have a little help to protect him? Oh, yes. But was he able to ward off the other kind of Esau, the one that came with open arms? Yes. He was able to get Esav to go on his direction at his pace and said, I'll catch up with you at the end of times, but I'm going my pace. I'm going my way. And the second question is what happened when they actually met? Yeah, it was Esav trying both. He tried falling on his neck. We'll try the Esav approach. And if that doesn't work, we'll try the brother approach. Kissed him. With dots all over the word. This is unfortunately, and that's why I named this class. What did I call it? I called it the danger. I had a good title for it too. It was called, anybody remember?
Text to messaging.
Yeah, but one second. It had a good title. Something about the dangerous enemy from within. That's something.
Yeah, that was it.
You have to be aware of this. There's two people, there's two philosophies that we have to be on guard for. One is more obvious than the other. But the key here is, and if I had more time, I would tell you, this is really the message of the holiday of Hanukkah, by the way. The right. Message of Hanukkah is in the midst of the darkness, in the midst of where it's impossible. There's no way that a small band of inexperienced amateur Jews were going to take on the Greek, great Greek army. And win. And what did they do? They lit a little candle. You want to dispel darkness? You don't have to turn the whole world upside down. Just light a candle. But what does a candle do? What does light do? It shines it on yourself to know what is the truth. Who are you? We even use the expression, right? To shed light on something. That means you see it for what it is. The holiday of Hanukkah is where we light the candle into ourselves. Who are we? What's important to us? What am I putting in jeopardy by not keeping my Jewish identity in the forefront of my mind? Whatever. We'll save it for another time in terms of Hanukkah. But understand that that's really the message here. And Yaakov understood that. And he asked God for help. It's hard to do on our own. But that's the message I wanted to share. Questions? Yes, Robin.
So what you're saying, I'm getting it with the United States, but how do you feel about the same argument for Israel?
It doesn't make it everywhere in the world. I don't mean it specifically. I live in this country. I think the state of Israel faces a similar problem. Assimilation is not just amongst the non-Jews. There's also a sense of assimilation of where we're traditional. I mean, just look at the statistics. The statistics are staggering. For those who are active participants in their Judaism, the likelihood of being able to pass down those positive messages to the next generation go up significantly. For those that are Jew by name or culture, the numbers bear it out that it doesn't survive past one, maybe two generations if you're lucky. That doesn't make a difference what country you're in. There's a lot of, for lack of a better word, assimilation even in Israel.
Right. I mean, so it gets me in reminding me of, you know, when the Messiah would come, when everybody is sort of brought back to Israel, but they mean far back to Israel spiritually, everybody's participating.
Yeah, there's a lot that has to happen between now and then for us to be able to get to that point. Listen.
Right. But they're not talking physically, just being there. It's spiritually.
That is correct. It's more important. The coming back physically is only an end result of getting everything else in order. The first step is getting the education out there that the world understands. World. Let's start with ourselves. We'll worry about the world next. It's a tough topic. I debated whether I should or shouldn't. It's a hard topic, but I think it's important to understand it. Liz.
Is it ever addressed that Jacob did do some questionable things?
Oh, yes. How many pages of research would you like to read over the weekend? Yes. It's discussed at length.
Okay.
Trying to understand Jacob's motivations, understanding whether it was the right thing to do, how he could have done it, a lot.
It within the Torah or?
Well, the Torah doesn't give the only thing I think you can glean from the actual text of the Torah regarding all those stories is God gave him a thumbs up.
So the end justified the means.
You asked me what you can glean. I didn't tell you all that goes in between that.
Right, but I think a thumbs up from God is pretty darn good.
Yes, and perhaps it's not an end justifying a means. Maybe it was justified because it was the right thing. There was no justifying it. It was the right thing to do. Now you ask me, how could that be? Welcome to the commentary. I can only tell you from an end result point, God clearly gave him a thumbs up on almost all of it. There were some things that God did take exception to. Okay? Jacob did not have an easy life. Okay. Of all the patriarchs, I generally think of Abraham going through the most trials and tribulations, but it's not really true. Jacob's almost his entire life is one challenging situation. He has his brother, even as a young child, the two of them are slugging it out. Mm-hmm. At a relatively young age, he has to leave his parents' home. Mm-hmm. Why? Because his brother swore to kill him. Oh, great. He goes from the kettle to the frying pan, the pot to the frying pan. He goes to Uncle Laban's house. Oh, that goes well. He gets cheated out of his wife. He gets cheated out, not his time with them. Hey, Okay, fine. He leaves Lavan. He meets Asa. He's got a fight with an angel now. Great. Okay, he's good to go. Hey, guess what's next? Joseph and his brothers. Oh, here we go. I mean, this goes on and on and on and on. Jacob's life from beginning to end.
What a struggle.
Is so hard. I'm not suggesting that's the reason why he does what he does. But keep it in context.
Okay.
What is going on here? There is so much more to these stories.
Okay. That's helpful. Thank you.
So Israel constantly had to wrestle.
Yeah. Yes. Israel had to constantly wrestle. Yes. Good play on words. All right. Sharon.
One quick thing. When you were saying that, you know, like we always had to look to what other people were doing, that we didn't even like make our own idols. We looked at everybody else's. Is that because we lacked a self-confidence or self-esteem to believe in ourselves and believe in what we knew was possibly correct?
I think there is a lot of truth to what you're saying. One of the biggest challenges we as a Jewish people have faced really is epitomized in the story of Moses going up the mountain to go get the Torah after God had spoken the Ten Commandments. We've never had a revelation of that magnitude ever. And a mere 40 days later, they're reveling around a golden calf. What happened? Like, seriously. It's a long story, but the long and short of it is, let's get two facts straight. Number one is that the Jewish people were told that Moshe is going to return in 40 days. So what went wrong?
They miscalculated.
Ah, how did they miscount? And don't say because Jews are bad at math. That's not true. Look at all the accountants around there. Okay? Jews are good at math. So how did they mess this up?
Impatient,
but they knew it was 40 days. What were they? Which day did they mess up on, Arlene?
All of them.
No, which day did they finally throw their hands up and say, we need a Aaron, get us a golden calf. What day was that?
39.
You have your choice. 1 through 40. Take your pick.
39.
Yes, the correct answer is 39. That is correct. Why did they miscalculate? Because the day that Moses went up, he went up in the morning. The Torah says he went up in the morning. Moses meant and should have perhaps explained it better that the 40-day count only counts as a full 24-hour period, which means the day he went up is not day one. Tomorrow will be day one.
Travel days don't count.
Half days don't count, exactly.
Travel days.
Travel day is very good. Travel days don't count, okay? So now, Sharon, how many days are they off by?
A half.
They're off by one day. Moshe will be here tomorrow. Right?
So they're flipping out.
They're flipping out one more day. In fact, Aaron tries again and again. He kept saying to them, Aaron knows the truth. Aaron knows that Moshe's coming back. So what does he say to them? Oh, I have a good plan. They want to build a golden calf. I got a great idea. Hey, guys, go home tonight. Ask your wives and your girlfriends and your daughters for their golden rings and stuff. Yeah. Thinking in his mind, there's not an ISIS chance you know where they are giving that up tonight. No flipping way. So he bought himself a day. That's all he needs. You know what the Torah says? The men took their own jewelry and gave it to him on the spot. They didn't even go home to ask their wives. They said, no, we'll give. And they gave whatever they had. That's what they couldn't wait. They were impatient. But Sharon, listen to this. Why is God so upset with them? Because why did they create this golden calf? Let's be very clear. Their main intention, the vast majority of the Jews when they built that golden calf, was not to replace God.
Replace Moses.
It was to replace Moses. They weren't replacing God. They had just heard God speak. It's impossible in one's own mind to jump off a cliff so quickly after hearing God speak. They had witnessed with their own two eyes the 10 plagues in Egypt, the splitting of the sea, manna from heaven, the clouds of glory. I mean, folks, you can be blind as a bat and still see it. So what is it that they flipped out about? They felt, and this is to your point, Sharon, they did not have the self-confidence that they could have a personal relationship directly with God. They felt they needed some kind of intermediary, some kind of in-between. Moses has always been the middle guy. He was the one who brought the plagues on behalf of God. He stretched out his hand over the sea and split it. He asked God to bring forth the water. He's the one. Oh my God, oh my God, oh my God. Moses is in here. Ah! We need a new Moses. Not we need a new God. We need a new Moses. They lacked that confidence. They still had, I hate to use the term, but they still had that slave mentality. I'm not worthy. I'm just a plebe. That has continued to plague us. We are so focused on, well, what are they going to think? And what are they doing? Oh, that's my, what happened to our own confidence? Have we not seen enough in history to know that we got this thing on our shoulder called God who's watching us? We have defied every odds out there. All the bookies in Vegas would have lost everything if someone bet against the Jews. We're still here. It doesn't make sense. But we ourselves don't see that, unfortunately. We're so caught up in fitting in and getting their approval. No, you have to have that pride within yourself that this is who we are. We can do this.
Can't see in this line.
So this is to your point, Sharon. I think that is definitely a role that plays. It plays a role in it.
Not to prolong this, but I mean, you're saying it's a lack of self-confidence. I see it as just a lack of faith. They have a lack of faith.
In whom?
Faith in God. No, I disagree.
That's why I disagree. It is not a lack of faith in God. We totally trust God. I don't think I'm up to it, though. I don't think I deserve to have that relationship with God. And therefore, I'm going to go follow something else where I have less responsibilities, less things to worry about. I don't lack faith in God. If you were to ask the most secular, irreligious Jew and say, do you believe in God? Do you have faith in God? The vast majority will say yes. The vast majority will say yes.
But if they had faith, they wouldn't doubt it. That's what I'm saying.
Well, in whom? But we don't doubt God.
If we look at the first two plagues, after the first two plagues, they went, Moses, you got this. You tell us. We can only hear the first two. Too much for us.
The two commandments. You don't mean the plagues.
Sorry. I meant the commandments. My apology. Yes. Right. Yes.
There was a certain lack of faith in themselves. Right, let me end with this. It's really late. Every morning we wake up and thank God we wake up. But thank God we say Moda Ani, that beautiful prayer, right? Of thank you, God, for giving me another day. So Moda Ani Lefanecha Melech Chai V'Kayom Shechazarta B'Nishmati, that you have returned my soul to me, B'Chemla, with tremendous grace and compassion, Rabba Emunotecha. I'll just translate literally. Rabba Emunotecha, great is your faithfulness. The simple understanding that most commentators say means we are expressing our faith in God. How great is your faithfulness? We can trust that every night, I go to bed, I hand back my soul to you, and I trust, I have faith that tomorrow you will return it to me. That's how most understand it, and it's 100% true. However, there are some commentators that flip this on its head, and they say just the opposite. You know what Rabba Emunotecha means? God, thank you for giving me another day and returning my soul to me. Why? Because you have tremendous faith in me. Great is your faith in me. You know why you returned my soul to me? Because you know I have what to accomplish. You know I have what to do in this world. My time's not up. You have faith in me that I can accomplish. Whoa, now we're talking. Now we're cooking.
Now I like that.
Wake up in the morning and say, I'm here for a reason. I'm here to make sure that I'm accomplishing something as a human being, as a Jew, faithful in my faith. That's what it means.
I like that. Rabba
Emunatecha, how great is your faith in me? That's how you wake up every morning. All right. Laryngitis will set in very shortly.
Have faith, Rabbi.
Any other questions? I'm happy to answer them.
Thank you.
Okay. Wonderful. You. Have a great rest of the week, a great Shabbos, and we'll see you next week, I hope. Stay safe.
Very much.
Thank you.
Bye.
Thank you.
Thanks, Monroe, for asking about my mom. Appreciate it.
Awesome.